up of a hireling that works at the church, that hires, that the church hires. I'm so glad you didn't hire me. You called me here. There's a big difference. And here we find people who wanted to change, and they were living under tremendous persecution in the first century. Many of them died at the hand of Nero, as did Paul. So here we find all this heavy persecution, and yet we see the Apostle Paul ministering from prison. This is one of four of his prison epistles. And then look at verse 6, if you would, and he encourages them so with a great promise, being confident of this very thing, that he, that is God, which began a good work in you, that is the believer at Philippi, and that is you and I also, will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. And we took that verse apart last week, and then we thoroughly examined the next two verses, verses 7 and 8, when Paul's personal love certainly eked out of his pen. Notice what it says in verse 7. Even as it is meet or fit or right for me to think this of you all. He was including everyone. He didn't leave anyone out. His precious friends of this church. Because I have you, notice what he says now, because I have you in my heart. Paul had a close relationship. You are in my heart. I'm not there. I'm in a Roman prison. Many of them didn't even know where he was at that time. They didn't have Facebook. But here we find Paul saying, you are in my heart. I am in these bonds, speaking of his imprisonment. They're in the Roman prison. I am in bonds, but I want you to know you're in my heart. And he also said, and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you're all partakers of my grace. And I dealt with that verse and also verse 8. Notice what it says. Another verse of endearment. For God is my record. How greatly I longed after you all in the bowels, or the compassion, the deep-rooted compassion, where the emotions begin to stem out from. And every time the Bible talks, the New Testament talks about bowels, I mentioned to you last week, it's speaking about the deep-rooted compassion that's deep within. It speaks about the bowels of mercy and the bowels of grace and the bowels of Jesus Christ. It's speaking about the great love he had for them. So he uses, now watch this, he uses the greatest and the strongest of terms to deal with these sweet people that he could not get out of his heart or his mind because he loved them so from the first day that he walked into the field. So now, in the balance of this book, in the balance of this paragraph of chapter 1, Paul now segues his way into a whole nother thought. He now departs from this matter of our personal relationship with each other. He now leaves that intimate relationship that he spoke so sweetly of, and he moves from his personal relationship to now how he was praying for them specifically. Now, I have a question for you, and I want you to put your thinking caps on and think with me just for a moment. If Paul transitions into how he is praying for the church at Philippi, and we know that this book is written for us, even though Paul wrote it hundreds and hundreds of years ago, is it not proper to think whatever Paul is going to say about praying for this church that he loved with all of his heart and soul, would it not be wise for us to realize that these prayer requests that he had for that church should become the prayer request of our church, and how we should learn from his prayer request? What were they? What exactly was he talking about when he began to pray for them. You see, prayer is often overlooked. It's considered the last resort. Oh, we have a need. We need to pray. It's not that we've been praying. Who prays enough? None of us. Praying is like giving, and praying is like soul winning. Who does enough of it? None of us do enough of it. It's a constant reminder. But it's important for us to consider what Paul did not pray for them about. And I made a list sitting at my desk. He did not pray for wisdom and understanding. You remember that was Solomon's prayer in the Old Testament. Lord, I not ask for riches, I ask for wisdom and understanding. It's a good prayer request, but that's not what Paul prayed for the church at Philippi. Nor did he pray for their health or their wealth or their livelihood. It's interesting to note. Is it wrong to pray for health? No. Third John speaks about praying for their health and prosperity. Nothing wrong with praying about those things, but that's not what Paul prayed for them about. Neither did he pray for them to have a greater zeal of spreading the gospel. Although that's important, I'm not talking down any of these points. I'm just saying, when we read it in just a few moments, we'll find none of this in his prayer. He did not include any specific correction on doctrine like he did the church at Corinth and other churches, rebuking them for their sin. That's not found in this prayer. Nothing wrong with preaching and praying against sin. We should do it. But that's not in this prayer. It did not contain one word of encouragement, although they were living under the heavy hand of Nero and all of his imps as they were persecuting Christians. Persecuting the church did not stop when Paul got converted on the road to Damascus. It increased exponentially, day after day, month after month, year after year. They were under heavy persecution. When you got saved, you were often ostracized from your family. You often lost your job if your boss was a heathen. It was a horrible day when people got saved. We look at it as a great day in their life, physically and emotionally and materialistically speaking. It was a bad day for them. The church became their only family. And Paul had three main concerns, none of which were what I thought they would be. It's interesting. This brings me to us seeing and understanding the proposition that I have for you in my sermon this morning. And that is, we must have a heart of compassion that is discerning. I'm going to deal with love today, but I'm not going to deal with it in a way in which you think I may deal with it. I'm going to deal with it in the context of this verse, as it lies in its context. We need to have a mind that is clear and able to make godly decisions. Life is filled full of decisions, small and great. And every one of them needs to be made with the mind of Christ and not our own mind. A mind that is clear and able to make the right choices, and also a will that seeks out righteousness and not worldliness, a will that has been broken over their sin and open to the change in their life. You see, the heart and the mind and the will was important to Paul as he dealt with these three prayer requests that touches all three of these. And Paul knew that under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, that as he gave them these prayer requests and how he was personally praying for them, that it would touch their heart, that it would change their mind, and it would stir their will to change. it would focus off of the persecution and off of their tribulation and off of their sickness and off of their poverty. It would focus off what consumed their mind every day they got up. Where's the meal going to come from today? Who will hire me? How will my children be fed? Oh, we are so spoiled in America in the 21st century. Life is good to us. We have figured it out. And here Paul is reminding these precious people of how he was praying for them. And this will take us into the deeper water. This will take us away from the shallow end and help us see the greater truth as we examine Paul's prayer request for them. It begins in verse 4. Go back up to verse 4 and let me show this to you. Always, notice it, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making request with joy. When Paul used the word always, he was saying, and he was laboring to do so, to remind them that he had not forgotten them. You are not forgotten. I want you to know that. You remember? He could remember the first day he walked on the field. He hadn't forgot them. In every prayer of mine, this was a proof of particular and special affection that Paul had for them. Though there were many people under his tutelage, though there were others, even besides Timothy and Silas and Barnabas, there were others that demanded his time, yet he was taking his time to remind this church that he had not forgotten them in prayer. And when he said, "For you all," those were words that included everyone in the church. This is not a general request. Lord, bless the missionaries and bless our family. This is not general. This is specific. And all meant all. And notice he was making his request with joy. Paul knew they were under that heavy hand of persecution. He knew they were discouraged. He knew that they were faced with trials and tribulations much more than you and I are faced with today. So Paul let them know in his own loving way that his requests for them, those requests were mingled with joy and thanksgiving. He was thinking about his personal relationship with them some 11 years ago. This would help their endurance. This would bring them along to know that someone truly cared, that someone would take the time from prison and write to us and say to us that he loves us. And in so saying, we would be comforted to know that someone truly cared. That's the deeper thought here. It's not the shallow surface of even their immediate need. It was their spiritual need that he was after. And often, now watch this, often the spiritual need is what we really need to put our finger on. But see, we do not want someone to diagnose that, because that's a spiritual problem. We'd rather talk about materialism, our health, our physical needs. No. None of those are mentioned here. And he is saying, I want you to know, I haven't forgot you. And I am praying for you. And I am praying, making these requests with joy, knowing that God would hear his prayer and encourage their heart. And oh, how it did. So as we focus on verses 9, 10, and 11, the last three verses of our text that we've been examining for the last 4 weeks, I want you to consider one more time how Paul did not pray for them. He did not pray that God would give them riches and prosperity. I want this in your mind. Or good health. Or greater zeal for the gospel. As Jesus commissioned the disciples, that God would not stop their persecution. He didn't say that. And listen, dear friends, God has never promised his children that they would not suffer persecution. God has never promised that. He does promise us that he will be with us all through the persecution. That's the promise. But he does not promise that we will be without suffering, hurt, and the need of help in some fashion in our life. And when you and I realize that, that's when prayer can become a greater opportunity to see others and their need over me being so self-absorbed that it's all about me. So God did not deliver them from the tyranny of Nero. Instead, he focuses on their immediate spiritual needs. Now, there's an application here that I want to make. Think with me just for a moment. This is what a true under-shepherd will do when God reveals to him the real spiritual need of the people. Paul reached into their heart. He didn't reach into their life. He reached into their heart and he put his finger on the pulse of their issue and their real need. And wise is a pastor who will not be afraid to compromise by covering up the needs, the spiritual needs of the people in whom God calls him to lead. He has to do it in love. Without love, it profiteth us nothing. Speak the truth in love, Paul said to the church at Ephesus. We do it in love. But we do it without compromise. We do it without apology. What do you really want out of church? A social event? A socialization of friends? Or do you really want spiritual help and your needs really met and you have to really think through your own garbage and junk so that you can make the right choice? What do you really want? A social club, you can find that in the world. We're not a social club. We're the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth. And we have to have the truth preached to us. And those who really want the truth, they take it to heart. They might get spitting mad, but they can also get real happy that God has told them something that has helped them and not sugarcoated something. So Paul's three requests are quite unique and unusual. They went deep into the soul of every Philippian believer. They made them think through things that they had not considered yet. They were now focused off of their physical and outward needs, and now they were focused on the spiritual needs. You see, his prayer included the condition of their heart, the clarity of their mind, and the commitment of their will. And these requests are needed in our lives today. They must be evidenced. If they are not evidenced in our lives, we will not walk in holiness. We will not walk in his righteousness. We will not walk as dedicated, true believers that love God with all their heart and all their soul and all their might. We will be more concerned for the perfect and complete will of God than we will worldly gain and what's my salary going to be and how much bonus will I get and what about my retirement? I'm not saying that those things are wrong. Those things are important and we should plan for all of them. I'm not speaking down to that. But we can become so focused on ourselves. We can become so narcissistic in our thinking that all we have on, in our minds would be the material things of this life. Paul wanted to be sure that he extracted that out of their thinking and that he replaced it with something far better that would give them more comfort than all the money in the world. So let's look at these three requests in our balance of time. Here's the first one. Their compassion had to do with the condition of their heart, beginning in verse 9. This I pray. So there's the request. Here they go. This I pray, that your love abound yet more and more. That your what abound? You tell me. Your love. Now, Paul uses the strongest of all the Greek words for love here. It is the word agape. And this word is not just descriptive, but this word is demanding. It is the sacrificial love that Jesus Christ had in going to the cross for us. This is the strongest of all the words that he could have used. So he's talking about love, abounding, yet more and more. Now, I want you to notice what it abounds in. And we're going to take this apart this morning. What does it abound in? Oh, in giving big offerings. No, nope, that's not what it says. That your love for one another will abound in helping one another and being benevolent toward one another. Nope, that's not what it says. That your love would be seen and heard from your lips and your arm would embrace someone in their need. Nope, that's not what it says. That your love will take your brother or your sister and drive both of you to your knees, and that you would become great prayer partners and great prayer warriors for the Lord. Nope, that is not what it says. And you see, that's the common thought when we think about love. I want you to look at the deeper truth here. Notice what it says. This I pray, that your love abound, may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in judgment. Human reasoning often distorts real agape love. Not phileo love, not friendship, but agape love. You see, agape love does not give to get or to be recognized. Agape love does not lord over other people. Agape love does not threaten. If you don't do it my way, I'm going to resign. We hear that often among politicians. We just heard it this past week in politicians. You see, though love involves giving, its motive is always pure. It is not driven by some manipulative thought in mind of what I'm going to get in return. Love is not shallow in its thinking, neither is it shallow in its talking. Love knows when to talk and when not to. Love does not seek a quick fix based on feelings or how I want the outcome to be. Love is not empty sensationalism with emotions that escalate out of control. Love is never absorbed with self. Love is not getting people to feel sorry for you and your lot in life and all your problems and all your sicknesses and all your aches and all your pains. I said to you a few years ago, after a while, you'll know who to ask how you're feeling and who not to ask how you're feeling. No, love doesn't exploit someone's kindness. You see, agape love, according to this verse, will surprise us all. This love is anchored in Bible knowledge. And I'll tell you what that means here in just a moment. It is rooted in the truth of the Holy Scriptures. You see, this agape love has the ability to discern what God is doing in our life without blaming others. We are expert blame shifters. We do not want to own it ourselves. We do not want to own our poor decisions. We do not want to own it ourselves. We're willing to put it on someone else. We play the blame game. Those kind of people become bitter. They flip-flop from friend to friend, job to job, church to church. It's a sad thing. Their life is filled full of trials and sufferings, circumstances that they have to endure, many of which they brought upon themselves because of their poor decisions, because they didn't have knowledgeable love. They didn't have love that had good judgment. They made poor decisions because of it. So Paul was not praying for them to be kind one to another, as did Peter. It's a different context. It was a different circumstance. Or that they would give to the poor saints of Jerusalem as he instructed the rich saints of Corinth to do. No, here's the context, and please take this down and take it to heart. This love is not a love of doing something for someone, but rather it is a love that grows and matures as the believer goes through life and all of its blessings and difficulties. And we have both, do we not? You have them, I have them. And in this context, this is what Paul was saying to this church. Now let's look at it carefully. Go back to verse 9 with me if you would, and notice that his prayer included that their love will abound more and more in knowledge. This is the word in the language for full discernment. It is the ability to obtain sharp perception about life and the many decisions we have to make every day of our life. This gets magnified and personalized in verse 9. I'm amazed when Paul says that your love may abound. The word abound there is the word for super excess. In other words, it's to superabound. He is referring to the extent or the magnitude of their love. Now stay with me and put your thinking caps on just for a moment this morning. So when Paul says that your love may abound, he is referring to the extent or the magnitude of their love. Here's what Clark said about this. Abounding love should be like a river perpetually fed with rain and fresh streams so that it continues to swell and increase until it fills all of its banks and floods the adjacent plains. That's what abounding love is about. Now notice he uses these two terms, the word abound and then yet more and more. So now here he has two times told us about excess. Now when he says yet more and more, he's not speaking about the extent of their love, but rather he is speaking now of their effectiveness in their love. How effective will they be? Other than this, love becomes useless. You may give to your heart's content. You may have wherewithal. But here, this is not speaking about that. Their love should abound more and more. And we should adopt this kind of knowledgeable love, if we could call it that. So not only should they abound, yet more and more in knowledge, which is discernment. But now he turns the truth just a little bit. He rotates it just a little bit, and he allows us to see through another venue, and he's getting us to think. Now notice what it says, and we can go back to the first part of verse 9, that your love may abound more and more in judgment. It's not unfair, it's not unwise, and it's not wrong to read it that way. Judgment is somewhat different than knowledge. You see, judgment is the English word for our word for perception. It's the ability to have some antenna. We can look at things. We can perceive. We have a perception. And that perception can often keep us from making stupid decisions, sinful decisions, selfish decisions, because real love abounds yet more and more in knowledge, in discernment, and in judgment or in perception. You see, this word speaks to the moral insight of the practical application of Bible knowledge. It gives us the ethics and the morals in which become foundational in our decision making, so that we can use God's word as the basis of our moral choices. Now, here's what I want to say, and I want you to hear me clearly. Please, do not tell me that you love God and you live in fornication. Do not tell me that. You are contradicting yourself. You